I would like to call the Senate Committee on Health Care and Veterans Affairs to order. Today is February 10th, 2009, and we have snow coming down. I don't know if snow's still coming down. And I also read in the paper that birds are now migrating an average of 400 miles further north, so there must be some kind of climate change going on. So anyway, that maybe that means we're going to get more snow with climate change. Also, another issue that I want to bring to everyone's attention, the silent war that's killing our soldiers. I don't know if any of you have been reading that, but there are actually more American soldiers killed themselves in January than were killed by hostile action in Iraq or Afghanistan. And Oregon, similarly, an examination of the soldiers among Oregon members and veterans over the past 5 years show that more Oregon veterans died at their own hands rather than at the hands of their enemies. And so this is an issue, part of it, of what we, this committee, is dealing with, and I just wanted to put that on the record that this is very serious, and we want to make sure that we deal with those issues also. All right, with that, we want to have an informational meeting. As you know, we aren't really responsible for the provider tax in the Senate. Those revenue-producing bills are happening in the House, but it is important for this committee to hear what everyone has to say about the issue. So with that, we're going to have health care financial study, and Denise Hansel and John Lee, if you would come forward.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Denise Hansel, and I've been working in the healthcare industry for about 30 years, 25 with Kaiser Permanente, the last 13 as the Vice President of the Health Plan. I've also worked with the Oregon Institute of Technology to expand the healthcare workforce down in Klamath Falls. I've served on the Finance Committee of the Oregon Health Fund Board and chaired the Exchange Committee. And in 2004, I worked with and have continued to work with the Oregon Business Council on their healthcare reform initiative. And as a result of that work, this summer was asked to staff the newly created Health Leadership Task Force, which I'm very excited to share with you today the work of that group and the commitment of the healthcare leadership to address some areas of cost containment. So we have some information that we want to share with you. I want to talk a little bit about how the Health Leadership Task Force came to fruition. This last summer, the Oregon Business Council, the Associated Oregon Industries, the Oregon Business Association, and the Oregon Coalition of Healthcare Purchasers have always been and continue to be very concerned about healthcare costs in Oregon. And they asked the healthcare leaders to come together to help them address the cost issue facing Oregonians, their businesses, and their employees. So they asked six of the healthcare leaders, representatives from Providence, Legacy, OHSU, Kaiser, Regents, and ODS to come together and form a health leadership task force with two specific charges. One is to review the work of the health fund board and report back to the business community, those organizations, and the health fund board their sense of the cost containment initiatives that were under consideration and how effective they were going to be. But most important, to initiate several actions that could be taken fairly quickly to address the cost issues in Oregon. So the group came together and formed this committee, and there is a handout in front of you. This group, again, was created in this summer. It represents health plan, hospital, and physician leaders from across the state. There are 22 members of this group, and they have been working since September to identify some critical areas that they could work on collectively where they would have the greatest impact to control cost and get health care cost and premiums closer to the CPI, which is exactly what the business community asked them to do. So they wanted, the business, those four business organizations wanted to see some specific actions that could help keep premium increases closer to the CPI. The group has identified four areas that they are undertaking. There are about 120 people working on these efforts right now. These are areas that they felt they had the greatest opportunity to control costs, that they had the accountability and responsibility to implement actions. The business community supported this because they felt that they really needed the experts to start implementing some change. And so I wanted to share with you just briefly the four areas that are underway. The first group is on developing new reimbursement and payment approaches, focused on looking at new ways to reimburse providers to create the proper incentives for better efficiencies, reduced unnecessary care. The group has been working since September, and they have identified their initial focus being on the medical home concept for chronically ill. How could they create payment mechanisms to support the medical home concept? They're also looking at bundled services and pay for performance as a second item. The chair is Stephanie Dreyfus from Regents, and again, there's a group of probably about 15 to 20 people working on that effort. The second area...
There are no reports yet out on recommendations on these four areas?
No. The group's been meeting, Madam Chair and members of the committee, the group has been meeting since September. They are to come up with their first work plan in February. We're having a meeting February 20th next week to hear the reports out and to get the support and direction from the full leadership task force on these specific items.
Thank you.
The evidence-based practice group, this is a group of about 15, 20 people, almost all physicians from, again, across the state, and they're looking at high-cost medical areas and ways to implement evidence-based guidelines or best practice to reduce variation and get costs down. Dr. David Labby from CARE Oregon is leading that group. The co-chair is Dr. Roy Magnuson from OHSU. The third group is the value-based benefits group. They're looking at a lot of the work that was done through the Health Fund Board's Benefits Committee and looking at ways to come up with different benefit structures that would be available to both large groups and small groups, where they would provide enhanced benefits for preventive as well as chronic care management, and then a reduced benefit for nationally recognized areas where there is larger variation and unnecessary care going on. So that group is working, and we'll be coming up with that benefit structure to make available to employers shortly. And the last area, which was actually started earlier in the year, is administrative simplification. There are about 75 people working on this effort, and they have identified three areas of focus: provider credentialing, eligibility, and prior authorization. So this group has some specific identification of the problems that the providers face and are recommending some solutions. Bart McMullen and Andy Davidson are the two chairs of that group. Again, the groups will be reporting back to the full task force on February 20th to get the next steps outlined for implementation and direction. So I think what's important is the business community, those four business groups, felt they really wanted to ask the experts who could actually make some changes quickly to come together and to take on this charge, and they are doing that, and they're very committed to implementing some actions to help the business community and individuals have more affordable costs going forward.
And remind us again, who instituted the formation of this task force?
Chair Anderson and members of the committee, the request came from the Oregon Business Council, the Associated Oregon Industries, the Oregon Business Association, and the Oregon Coalition of Healthcare Purchasers. And they asked the healthcare leaders to come together and formulate this committee to get some action done.
And were they a part of the Oregon Health Fund Board Financial Committee? or whatever subcommittees they had.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the six folks that were asked to pull the group together, except Bart McMullen was on the Oregon Health Fund Service Delivery Committee, but none of the others were involved in the Oregon Health Fund Board efforts. They're getting engaged now and are very eager to get this work done.
I think once the rubber hits the road, all of a sudden everyone wants to make sure that they're part of the solution. I'm glad that they want to be a part of the solution. Okay.
My name is John Lee. I'm formerly responsible for the Oregon Region for Providence Health System, where I worked for 25 years. I've been retired for about 6 years, and in that interim period of time, I've done a lot of volunteer work assisting Denise on this project and also helping Providence on a variety of projects. My role today is to walk you very quickly through the Milliman report and explain the context for it. You have it before you, I believe, and we're going to go through the executive summary. If anybody wants a full copy of the report, they're available on the side over here, and Bob can also make those available to you. Madam Chair, just to amplify a little bit for Denise, our group fundamentally believes that healthcare does need reform, and that the best way to do that in the end is to get the people that have to change the system engaged in a meaningful way. And so we've got a combination of health plans, physician groups, and hospitals that are working on this. This is not intended to supplant legislation. It's intended to enable the implementation in a much more successful way, and the feeling is a lot of work in healthcare reform doesn't necessarily require legislation. For years, when you talk to anybody in the healthcare industry, one of the things they point to when you start talking about healthcare costs is that, well, it's all that cost shift, you know, that we get from underpayments on Medicare and Medicaid, and no one really had the precise numbers. There were lots of guesses on it, at least in Oregon. So our group said, we don't want to get lost on the issue of cost shift, so let's have a study done, understand what it is, and move on to the rest of the issues, which is around the four committees that Denise talked about. So Milliman, which is a nationally known company, was engaged, and I'm just going to hit the high points of their conclusions. If you look at Table 1 on page 2, two-thirds of the cost shift that is incurred in Oregon, and later on you're going to hear it's about 13.5% of the commercial premium that people under 65 pay for their insurance, is cost shift, that where commercial is essentially overcharged for underpayments on Medicare and Medicaid or charity and bad debt. And so the average commercial premium incurs about a 13.5% increase. That's slightly higher than the national average by about maybe 2 to 3% higher in Oregon than in other states. Two-thirds of the cost shift is related to Medicare, you know, which was an eye-opener. I've been in the industry a long time. It's the first time I've seen it quantified, because we keep thinking it's the uninsured population, other groups. Well, two-thirds is Medicare. Medicare pays somewhere around 85% of cost, you'll see later on. And we're in a situation where Oregon gets paid less than other states because of historic efficient practice of medicine in this state. So we get penalized. And anyway, it ends up being a cost shift, and you can see that in Table 1. Medicaid is the bulk of the remainder of the cost shift. If you go to the next important point on page 3, the hospitals and doctors are probably 70% of the premium costs, and they end up with an average of about a 19% cost shift within those. And physicians actually have a slightly higher cost shift than hospitals. Table 2, the bottom of page 3, again, is the reference point for that. The average commercial premium has about a 13.5% cost shift in it. If you go to Table 4 on page 4, you'll see that the average net income for Oregon hospitals is about 3.9%, and it's been that way for about the last 10 years. And we'll show you a graph in that regard. If you now turn to Table 5, you'll see a graph, and there it's showing the profitability of different business lines, if you will, to a typical hospital. And you can see where on the top line with the triangles, commercial, that essentially we overcharge the commercial member in order to make up for underpayments on Medicare and Medicaid, but it's primarily Medicare. And, you know, about 50% of the Medicare population in the I-5 corridor are in Medicare Advantage. And the federal government is looking at additional cuts in Medicare Advantage as we speak. That if that happens, it could make the problem even worse. And so there's, we appreciate the governor has sent a letter to Washington asking for a special consideration for Oregon in regard to Medicare Advantage, recognizing this issue, and we're very appreciative of that. If you go, that's the basic work that Milliman has done in understanding the cost shift. We also asked them to model, and you have to remember, we commissioned Milliman back in the fall, probably around October and November, to do this study. And we said, model a couple scenarios for us and tell us, since we're concerned about cost shift and we're also concerned about the plight of business and the commercial premiums that they're paying, let's understand if we do certain things like add children, 60,000 children, or add 100,000 adults, what would be the impact on the commercial premium? And we realize you're going to have to make some assumptions about this, about match and things like that. So what they did on page 8, chart 5, is the scenarios they modeled, the first one was if there's a decrease in commercial membership of 10%, what would be the impact on the commercial premium if that were to occur? And what it says is, in order for hospitals and physicians to make the same net income that they're making now, and not an increase, you'd have to increase commercial premiums by 3.6% in order to make up for a 10% reduction in commercial. And in this state, we've gone from about, the commercial used to cover 62% of the population, now it's only covering 50% of the population. Business, because of the price of healthcare, is gradually moving to less coverage and covering less people because of the cost pressures they're incurring. We're concerned about what, you know, if you look at it, commercial underwrites the whole system, and we need to keep it viable. If we lose 10%, there could be a disaster that could occur. And to be honest with you, we've been tracking this, and the commercial membership in this state is off about 100,000 people from a year ago today till today, or a year ago from today to today. So this is a very fragile market that needs to be preserved, and we need to be cognizant of it as we look at other changes.
Just a question. When you say a 3.6% margin, how much is that in dollars, average? Millions?
I'm sure it's millions. I
much more than
millions. Yeah.
I don't know.
Talking about a 3.6% increase.
Yeah, it'd be a 3%
commercial premium
increase on top of the trend rate.
It's already double digit.
If the trend rate is 6% in commercial and we lost 10% of the existing commercial membership, we have to charge 9.6% trend rate to make up for it. It's so important in the whole context of healthcare in Oregon that we just need to be aware of it. It's not net income. It's the okay.
Understand. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the next scenario modeled was what would happen if there was a 10% increase in payment rates to providers in Medicaid in order to help offset the cost shift, and that shows a 0.8% reduction in commercial premiums. We then said, what would happen if we had added 60,000 children? paid for out of the general fund, and assuming the old S-CHIP match, not the new S-CHIP match, there would be a slight increase, almost minimal increase to the commercial premium. We also looked at what would happen if we continued to fund the 25,000 people in the Oregon Health Fund Board, and it showed that there would be a favorable increase of about 0.1%. Again, the funds for this paid for out of the general fund. The last scenario was what would happen if we covered 100,000 people, and it showed a favorable increase of 0.5% reduction in the cost shift. Again, this would be out of the general fund. Now what they did on, and this is my final.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Yeah. I think ahead, you just misspoke. It's about the general fund. And what you're saying is you're looking at expansion of OHP standard. How would that affect the premium on the commercial side?
That's correct. That's
I think you just misspoke.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Yeah, it does come from general fund money with match from federal government, but it's a downward, it's a very minimal,
right,
but a very slight downward pressure,
right,
on premium increase.
Right, right. Yep.
Thanks. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for that clarification. Okay, and I misspeak a lot, so I appreciate that.
No, I do. I even speak about every other sentence, so I don't feel bad, okay?
Okay, the final chart is that we'll look at is the one on page 9, chart 6. And that's what would be the impact of adding 60,000 children with a 1.5% premium tax. And this shows the net number is in the boxes down below chart 6. It would be a 1.6% negative impact on the cost shift. If you look at the impact of the 25,000 standard, it would be 0.7%. And if you look at the 100,000 Oregon Health Plan people with funded by a 4% hospital tax, it would be a 1.9% net impact. Now, you know, what we're trying to do in Health Leadership Task Force is to get, to obtain economies. And, you know, it's going to be a long, slow effort. But the administrative simplification side, for example, if they can standardize the EOB claims and simplify parts on that, you know, we're hopeful that our work can mitigate some of this potential increases. And that's, you know, basically it. And we're hopeful that in the long run, this will be a partner with a variety of other initiatives that the state, Oregon Health Fund Board, and others, and health plans in particular, decide to implement. That concludes my remarks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'm really pleased that that you are trying to be a part of the solution. Senator Morris.
Thank
and
you,
then
Madam.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is almost a sidebar question to the issue at hand here, but you mentioned that we've had a reduction of 100,000 covered lives in the last year. And I'm wondering if there's a correlation between House Bill 2002 that was implemented in 07, which shifted, it broadened the pool, but it shifted the cost to that 26 to 50 former population. And I know in my district I've had numerous employers that just said, I can't do it, because they wound up with 50-60% increases in premiums, and it just they just didn't have the margins to do it.
Right.
And I'm wondering, is there a correlation between what we passed and 100,000 fewer lives covered?
Madam Chair and Senator Morse, we haven't looked at that specifically, but it should be looked at. You do hear that from small businesses that they are dropping coverage in order to continue their businesses. So the DCBS just came out with their 2009 report, so that might be something to look at. My sense is it's probably a little bit too early right now, because that looks at, I think, 2008 data, and I think that impact was effective in 2009, January.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a very important issue to bring before this committee, and talking with when we added the 2 to 25 into the... Is it the
26 to 50.
Yeah, to the 25 to 50. There were, I call it winners and losers.
Right.
So there was just as many winners as there were losers. So.
Madam Chair and Senator Morse, John just reminded me, what we're in the value-based benefits work group, we are trying to come up with a lower option benefit plan that would be available in the small group market. Again, using some of the concepts that were discussed during the Benefits Committee of the Oregon Health Fund Board, but applied more in an insurance-type mechanism. And we're trying to come up with a plan that would have a 20% price variation reduction on the medical cost. We have a meeting this afternoon but with the actuaries to see if they're able to get to that level. One of the questions that we all have is that the benefits, we're adding richer benefits for preventive and for treatment of the chronically ill, but in lieu of that, to get the price down, we're looking at national list about where there's unnecessary variation and overuse and using that to have a different benefit structure that would have higher co-pays and co-insurance. And I think the big question is what's the market acceptance of a benefit structure like that? But the group is working hard to see if we can come up with something with a goal of getting something in the market by January 2010.
Senator Bates?
More questions than answers, I'm afraid, but interesting information, at least. Dr. Lee, it's good to see you again.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure. I have a couple of questions about this. One was, first and foremost, this is all based on what you think true cost is, and finding out true cost for physicians and hospitals is no easy trick.
Mm-hmm.
How do you compare the cost on a daily basis for hospitals in Oregon compared to hospitals nationally? I know that our usage rate is down. We have the lowest number of admissions per population, and the length of stay is narrow compared to other states. So we get people, you know, in and out quickly. We have a lot of services to prevent them staying in the hospital longer than necessary. But I've heard some numbers indicating that as a result of those policies, which probably overall are good policies, that our daily costs are fairly high.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to have you give me a comment on that. I'm always concerned about how efficient hospitals are functioning,
mm-hmm.
especially with all the regulations the state and federal government lays on them, and liability issues they have to deal with. So could you give me a comment on that, please?
Yeah. Madam Chair and Senator Bates, I appreciate the question. I need to, for the record, I'm not a physician or a doctor. I appreciate the compliment, though. As far as the answer to the question, Oregon has the absolute shortest length of stay in the United States and the absolute lowest number of patient days used in the United States. No other state has a lower average than we do. And we're seventh highest in terms of admissions per thousand. So we're in terms of a utilization of a hospital, it's a compact period of time, and we look good on those numbers. As a result of the compactness of it, and I haven't looked at the numbers recently, but you would assume that because more services are being jammed into a shorter period of time, you're going to have slightly higher costs, and that'd be what my guess is. But I can take your question and research it and send you a note to answer the question, because I really don't know where we stand. But I think my guess is we're slightly higher on a per-day basis, but on an admission basis, we're on the low end, the cost per admission. So it depends on if you look at it, cost per day or cost per admission.
Follow up? That'd be very interesting information to have, and I'd like to see the overall picture on that. You know, if it's
sure.
our cost mm-hmm. per day is this,
right.
you know, what's the cost per population right. for hospitalization in
sure.
the state of Oregon? And then you have to worry about what the outcomes are.
Sure.
Are we hurting
right.
people by forcing mm-hmm. into the hospital so
right.
quickly? Is it overall
right.
working for us?
Right.
So some information along those lines would be very important to certain of us. We'll have to have a discussion with hospitals over other issues very soon.
Sure.
And I'd like to have that information. I think it might be helpful to all parties concerned.
Okay. Very good.
Another question, if I could. Hospitals, you know, have little choice over whether they see Medicare or Medicaid patients other than by location. Physicians have that choice.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing a growing number of physicians who are taking only commercial payers They feel that that's the only way they want to function in their practices. Did you guys discuss in your discussions of these issues, what about physicians that don't take Medicare, don't take Medicaid, only take commercial, knowing the commercial rate is set based on a cost shift, mm-hmm. or who have practices that don't have that involved in it? I mean, right. And then there's physicians who have primarily done Medicare and Medicaid mm-hmm. as a social right. value right. or safety net clinics who are taking care of these people. Right. There's some real disparities amongst physicians. Was there a discussion about that?
There hasn't been, Madam Chair, Senator Bates, there hasn't been yet. But I am confident that there will be. And you know, if you go back again to the Milliman data, essentially we're incenting everybody in the healthcare system to see only commercial patients because the profitability is so great relative to Medicare and Medicaid. And we know there are a number of closed practices to traditional Medicare, not just Medicaid, but traditional Medicare recipients also have a tough time gaining access. I think a lot of physicians are in medicine because they went into it to serve the greater good, and they carry that on in their practices. But increasingly, this is a greater and greater problem, and it's going to have to be addressed someplace down the line. The disparity between the profitability of the business lines, if you will, between commercial Medicare and Medicaid are so great. That we're essentially, you know, a lot of physicians can't afford to serve only Medicaid and Medicare. Their take-home pay is so significantly less that it presents a real problem. So we have not gotten into that, but I suspect we will when it's part of the committee that I staff, the reimbursement committee.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Senator Cruz, and then we need to move on.
Okay. I'm really disappointed that neither of the two gentlemen at that end of the dais brought up tort reform, but
there's still time.
There's still time. I guess, Madam Chair,
Key question. You're absolutely right.
Well, it is. I'm excited about this, interested in this. I'm hoping that we have them back to help inform the decisions with the other discussions going on in the building. Clearly, I'm interested in I've been looking for a better product that we can offer the individual and small group market. And that, I think, could be a key component of this. So, Madam Chair, when they have something to report, please bring them back so that we can be informed on these things.
Absolutely. Great.
Thank you very much.
With that, I'd like to close the informational meeting on healthcare finance, on the healthcare financial study, the Health Leadership Task Force. And colleagues, we need to introduce some committee measures, and if I could, I'd like to open a work session on the possible introduction of measures.
These?
There's two.
Three of them.
Three.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
I move LC 1846, dated 12/3/08. LC 2487, dated 1/28/09, and LC 2830, dated 2/5/09, be introduced as committee measures.
Senator Cruz has moved those major LC drafts as stated. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. With that, I'd like to close that work session and open a work session on Senate Bill 25. And would you remind us what that bill was?
Senate Bill 25 establishes the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board. You may recall a discussion a few weeks ago. There have been the public hearing a few weeks ago. Since then, there have been a couple of amendments, two of which we'll vote on today. One is a minor clarification on reimbursement of those advisory board members related to legislative members. The second amendment has to do with the makeup of the board. As you may recall, there was some discussion about including on the board specifically employees of the Oregon State Hospital who would be appointed to the board, with some discussions with Senator Courtney and others who were interested in the bill. They did come up with Amendment 4, which is in your packet. It does not increase the number of board members, but simply adjusts the mix of board members to include a board-certified physician employed by Oregon State Hospital, a certified licensed board-certified nurse employed by Oregon State Hospital, and a direct care staff employed by Oregon State Hospital who will be members of the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board.
With that, I'd like to have Sasha come up from President Courtney's office and just give us a brief history of how we came up with what we have and how everyone is happy.
That's a big task.
Senator Monica Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sasha Pollack. I work in Senator Courtney's office. At the last public hearing, we heard testimony from a variety of folks related to the makeup of this board of directors, advisory board for the state hospital. Senator Courtney's office has been working on this through the interim during with the state hospital patient care, joint committee on patient care at the state hospital, and Senator Courtney felt that this was a good mix. It included both outside technical staff and inside technical staff to give us both an objective exterior perspective on what current practice is and also an inside day-to-day view of from the staff who are actually working with the patients. It also includes still advocacy folks, a member of the local neighborhood, and two consumers, I believe, and a family member that have dealt with mental illness. So I'm happy to take any questions, but I think that I tried to touch base with folks and make sure that committee members were okay with this mix of folks.
And that's the dash ones and the dash four.
That is the dash fours.
Dash fours.
And then we needed to have the dash ones for technical fix. So is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, just a question, because
yes.
With the expenditure statement on the dash ones, it calls for $66,827, and on the dash four, it's $30,313. Why the difference?
And I have not.
Madam Chair, the Amendment 4 adjusts the keeps the membership at 11. Fiscal office on the first one misread the statement. They sent us a revised, which dropped to 30, around 30, and then the last amendment, because we added the state employees who would again not be subject to reimbursement for per diem, or it was dropped to $30,313, which is amendment 4 amendment, which I have here, and there's no revenue impact.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the just for edification, the dash one is a change, a technical change, which allows reimbursement for travel, but not for a per diem. That was the fiscal change on that. This, which is similar to all other boards and commissions, similar to this. Okay.
One other technical question, Madam Chair, because this is a general fund expenditure. Does this bill need to go to Ways and Means? Because I didn't see a subsequent referral on it.
And it's less than $50,000.
Well,
but I still think that,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe that the Senate President's office is aware of the fact that this is that fiscal on it. I will confirm, and we will make sure there's no need for a referral since it doesn't currently have one. If there is one, we will make sure it gets it.
I guess, Madam Chair, my confusion is this does have an actual general fund obligation in it.
Absolutely.
And we've got referrals on some bills that have no general fund obligation in them, and we have to send them down.
So I would prefer not to do anything with this bill, and we'll have the administrator check with President Courtney's office. And at this point, let's just do it, because it'll be a quick pass on, because we do want to prevent these bills going down to Senator Bates' committee.
Thank you.
If they don't need to be. And this may be one that may not have to, because it's under $50,000. Yeah.
My conversation with Phil Bentley was that all bills have to have that impact statement, period.
Well, it does. It has the impact statement. And it's at $30,000.
Well, then it has... Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the clarification that I had, that if it has any money attached, it has to go to Ways and Means. but if it doesn't have the attached, you can't pass it out. So.
Yeah.
I think it'd be well to check.
Yeah.
Even though that is the president's bill.
Okay.
He may make an exception.
Madam Chair, just a quick comment, if I could. I want to thank Sasha for doing a great job on this, and it took some recommendations that I received from other groups, and we kind of put it all together and mixed it up, and then she took it to the president, he okayed it, and I think it's a good bill now. And thanks for a lot of hard work of running around and sort of kind of corral everybody and keep everybody on the same page, and I assume everyone has bought off on this from what I've heard, so I think we're okay on this now. Yeah.
Right.
And Madam Chair, I'm not trying to kill or delay anything. I just
no.
want to make sure that
I agree.
Okay.
No.
It's just process at this point.
Well, it may be an important process. In the budget environment we're in right now, I think it's important we treat all bills equally. And as much as I don't want any extra work done on my committee, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
It may well need to come.
Well, this would be an easy one, though, wouldn't it, Sandra?
And there are never any easy ones. There's never an easy one. And you think it's easy, and there's always something that goes wrong. You got to run through the committee, you got to run through the full, and then you got to get back out to the floor. So we'll wait and see.
All right. Thank you very much. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 139 and... 25.
Madam Chair, can we at least move the amendments in? Can we do that? Or do we have to
vote on the amendments?
Can
we at least vote
on the
amendments, get those done?
Okay, so now that I've closed the work session, how do I get in?
You just reopen it.
Just
reopen it.
Okay, I'm going to reopen a work session on Senate Bill 25.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 25.
Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 25. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move the -4 amendment to Senate Bill 25.
Senator Cruz moves the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 25. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And Mr. Shook will check to, and I will check also with the President's office because it does have a slight fiscal. All right. With that, I close the work session on Senate Bill 25, and I'm going to open a work session on 139. Do you want to bring us up to date on that?
Sure. Senate Bill 139, Madam Chair, you heard public testimony from the Oregon Board of Nursing. What this would do is delete the requirement that the Oregon Board of Nursing shall issue a wallet-size license as evidence of current Oregon licensure. And there were no amendments since our public hearing.
We now have the fiscal. I would like to entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 139 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Yes, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 139 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
I think you should carry it, Madam Chair.
All right, I'll carry Senate Bill 139. And with that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 139. And I'd like to open a public hearing on SCR 4. And I think that's Senator Bates is going to talk to us. Do you want to give us a summary of what this is?
Yes, Madam Chair. Hank Collins was our director of human services for the county and was sort of a legend in his own time. He did a wonderful job in Jackson County and was revered by everyone in the community. He brought people together over and over again and died an untimely and unexpected death last year from acute lymphocytic leukemia. This is a memoriam for him, and I would ask that if you have an opportunity to read through this, I won't take a lot of committee time, we'll do more on the floor, but that we pass this out and we set a time for it when his family can be here from Jackson County, and we'd have to have a little time to communicate with them and to arrange for that, because this is going to be very important, that those family members, and to some of the community in Jackson County. He was an exceptional man. Those of you who know him, he had this wonderful southern drawl from down in Tennessee in the south, and he would just kind of work you on things and get you there in the end. He was just a wonderful individual, a fine human being, and we sorely miss him in Jackson County.
All right. Is there a witness? Okay, we'd like to read into the record a letter from Mel Cohn from the Department of Human Services, and he wanted to say a few words in appreciation of all the work that Hank Collins did. And Senator Bates, do you want to just read?
I would be glad to get that in the record, and then we'll have more on the floor, obviously. This is to the Honorable Lori Mons Anderson, Chair. It's from Mel Cohn. Many of us know him. He's the Public Health Director for State Health Officer for Oregon. Chair Mons Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to say a few words of appreciation of all the work that Hank Holland did for the public's health in Oregon. Hank was a consummate health administrator. He was trained in public health, skilled in management, and advocate for those with less humble and always ready in his way to let you know how the world could be different. These county health administrator positions are some of the most difficult ones in our system. The political terrain is bumpy and can shift quickly. There are serious competing priorities. There is seldom enough money. There are not enough people to supervise or plan to do the work. The emphasis on social justice raises many complex issues for the community. Hank showed us how to do all of that. A few years ago, we had a serious shortages of flu vaccine that appeared literally as the vaccine campaign opened. Hank and the Jackson County staff, Hank always said we, were the first to bring community immunization providers together to discuss and plan distribution of the limited supply. That is Hank working for his community. When he found out that some providers were off the plan, he was right there, and not just to help them join the community plan, but to literally count people in line to make sure the line 100s long did not exceed that particular supply, and find chairs for those who wouldn't be able to stand too long. That is Hank working for the individuals he cared so deeply about. Hank was always a strong supporter of public health education. His path from the rural Tennessee to a bachelor of science degree and then a master in public health degree was an example for all of us. We currently have a graduate certificate in public health offered through the Oregon Master's in Public Health program and have been working to make this training opportunity accessible to public health administrators as a way to raise the capacity of our public health system. I encourage you to honor Hank by including specific questions about education and public health when committees review our state approach to higher education. We miss Hank both as a personal friend, but also as a professional inspiration to all of us in public health. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is there any further question? Was there any other witnesses?
No.
Okay, with that, I'd like to close the public hearing on SCR4 and open a work session on SCR4. Senator Bates?
Madam Chair, I'd move that SCR4 be moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bates moves SCR4 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. And Senator Bates, would you like to carry that?
Glad to. Thank you.
And will you also work with Mr. Shook or the Secretary of the Senate? I'm not sure who has that responsibility to make sure that we schedule it on the day that we can get the family there.
We will do that.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, I'll close the work session on SCR4, and I'd like to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 117. And, Mr. Shook, would you
Senate Bill 117 exempts dental clinics at certain institutions of higher ed from requirement to have license to practice dentistry. Senate Bill 117 is a collaboration with the Oregon University System, School of Dentistry, Oregon Health Science University, and the Oregon Board of Dentistry in collaborating to get the exemption from the clinics. And there is representatives here with public testimony. We also have an amendment, 117-2.
All right. I assume then Paul, is it Kleinstead? And Lori Lindley, if you'd like to come forward first.
Good morning, Chairman Sanderson, committee. My name is Lori Lindley, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General from the Department of Justice, and I represent the Dental Board, among other health agents, health licensing boards.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the community, for the record, I am Dr. Paul Kleinstub. I'm the dental director and chief investigator for the Oregon Board of Dentistry.
Who's going to go first?
I don't have any testimony per se. I'm here to answer any questions that you may have.
Excellent.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, on behalf of the Oregon Board of Dentistry, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding Senate Bill 117 with the -1 and -2 amendments. The Oregon Board of Dentistry worked with the Oregon University Systems to repair an oversight in ORS 679.020, which did not allow institutions of higher education listed in ORS 352 2-00-002 to operate and own dental clinics under the current exemptions found in ORS 679.020. However, in developing Senate Bill 117, some grammatical changes were inadvertently made that could cause the Oregon Board of Dentistry a problem in enforcing the provisions of the ownership of a dental practice in the state of Oregon. The current Oregon law, which is supported by an attorney general's opinion, would have been changed, thus rendering that attorney general's opinion void, and the ability of the Oregon Board of Dentistry to defend that statute could be compromised. The Oregon Board of Dentistry has worked with the Oregon University Systems to amend Senate Bill 117 and remove those grammatical changes. The Oregon Board of Dentistry supports the -1 and -2 amendments, which will return Senate Bill 117 to the original intent that the Oregon Board of Dentistry and the Oregon University Systems agreed upon. I'd be happy to answer any of the committee's questions.
In the -2 amendments, just clarify again that a person may not practice dentistry without a license. That's lines 4 and 5. And then it added 9 through 11. Only a person licensed as a dentist by the Oregon Board of Dentistry may own, operate, conduct, or maintain a dental practice, office, or clinic in this state. With regionalization, et cetera, are there dental clinics that are, say, owned by a corporation, yet the local dentists, do they would have definitely a state license? Is there a conflict with that scenario at all?
Madam Chair, under current law, with the exceptions noted in 020, only a licensed dentist may own and operate a dental clinic or dental office.
Okay. I guess I'm still confused because I thought that there were clinics, dental clinics,
yes,
that are corporations, yet those corporations are still owned by dentists and not by a group of individuals with dentists working for them? I'm thinking like a hospital structure. I mean, we have the hospital.
Well, Madam Chair, for example, in the Kaiser system, there is a dental branch associated with that. It's called Permanente Dental Associates. But that is an entity owned by dentists still. There are community health clinics. There are
managed care plans.
There are county clinics. There are clinics operated by labor organizations. All those are exemptions under 020.
Gotcha.
That may.
That's what I needed to have clarified.
Yeah.
Thank you. Senator Bates.
Madam Chair, this brings back a really bad memory for Senator Cruz and myself when we were House representatives, and we had a similar issue in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
And the dental board and the state organization for dentists, which I'm not sure what their name is right now.
The ODA.
ODA, Oregon Dentist Association, got crosswise on this issue. And their issue was involved in this, or one, what happens if a dentist dies and his wife has to run the practice
Absolutely.
For a while and she's not a dentist and can't own it? And the dental board had one, the law clearly states one thing, the dental board was on one side and dentists were on the other, and the bill went down to a hearty defeat trying to straighten that mess out. There was already at that time and still in place exemptions from a dentist owning practice, one of which was set up for labor. One dental clinic here in this town. This is a very strange law requiring that dentists own the practice or own the business that runs this. And it's very strange, rather unique to Oregon. As a result, as an example, in our managed care organizations for Medicaid, those programs have to be owned by a dentist. You have to have somebody on the letterhead that's the owner of it. And this is trying to carve out, I believe, an exemption for schools. And before I vote for this baby, I want to know whether the ODA is again before we get into problems. Now, you're assuring me that they're okay, but I'm going to tell you, my previous experience is that you better have them up here in front of us talking to us.
They're on the list.
Okay, before I take a step out into that landmine field again and get my foot blown off. I think it's a very strange law, but the dentists feel very strongly about it. Mm-hmm. And that's okay with me. But I want to hear from them, and I don't want anybody to change their mind later on when we get to the floor. Okay?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was the point I was trying to make, because from the recesses of my mind, I know that there were conflicts in the past and why dentists have to be so territorial on their clinics. But we are getting the exemptions that we need, and I guess that solves some of the problems. Is there any other discussion on this? Thank you so much. And let's call Margie, is it Huffman? Huffman and Chip Lazaby.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Margie Huffman, and I represent the Oregon Dental Association, and I am happy to be here today. We worked with the Oregon University System and the Oregon Board of Dentistry to craft the Dash 2 amendments to clean up the language of the bill, but I'm happy to say that we support the bill with as amended in the Dash 2s.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Lazenby. I'm general counsel at Portland State University. I think the effect of the Dash 2s, Senator Bates, is meant to put the original language that resolved all that back in place through legislative counsel's initial drafting of this. They were trying to clean it up grammatically, and the board caught it and decided they wanted to keep the language exactly the way it was because of the landmines that you mentioned.
Yeah.
This is really a housekeeping bill from the university system's point of view. We worked out a regulatory piece with the dental board when it was discovered that we did not have the same exemption that OHSU does from this regulatory scheme. We operate dental clinics, provide services to our students, as does the U of O. University of Oregon has submitted written testimony that will be a part of the record for you to examine in support of the bill and the Dash 2s as well. So it's with the Dash 2s, it's back to the housekeeping measure that I originally intended it to be when I started all this, unfortunately.
I don't see any Dash 1s, so I assume that no one is advocating the Dash 1s.
Yeah. Chair Mona Sanderson, there, and members of the committee, there was there were language problems with the Dash 1 amendments, which is why we worked with legislative counsel to have the Dash 2 amendments drafted.
Okay.
And the Dash 2s are the ones that have been signed off on by OUS and ODA and OBD.
Excellent. Is there any other further question then?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is more than a little embarrassing. It was 58-2. A Republican and a Democrat went down together on that one, okay?
Who were they, Senator Bates?
Someone that I really like. And I like the other guy, too. I would just request one thing. When we get the Dash 2s, do we have the Dash 2s action?
Yes, Dash 2s.
Okay. When the Dash 2s are in if we vote them in today, I would ask that the...
That
your board comes down here in person, and I'm bringing a scalpel out. We're going to sign this in blood. Okay?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Bates, done and done.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Any other comments?
Yeah, just the outline issue from way back when is still outlined.
Still there.
So, mm-hmm.
And that's what the Dash 2s are going to address. When I saw the original language, my first reaction was, oh, here we go again. And I assumed that the ODA was going to step up and offer something different, which they did. So.
Okay. So all right. We don't have a fiscal. Any other comments? We will be bringing back once we get a fiscal. And with that, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 117. And I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 130. Mr. Shook, would you give us a summary?
Senate Bill 130 authorizes the Oregon Board of Licensed Dietitians to prorate dietitian license fees. And I believe their executive director is here today to address that.
Okay. The witness registration, there's no one to...
Dr. Van Vliet.
Oh, Mr. Doug
Van Fleet.
Yes, Van Fleet.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doug Van Fleet, the Executive Secretary of the Board of Examiners of Licensed Dietitians. We would like to have your action amending our statute so that we can prorate licenses monthly instead of annually, thereby saving applicants a substantial amount of money, costing the board $3,500 per biennium, but I think that we can make that up from savings. And I think the gain that we have in public relations with applicants will more than pay for the deficit.
This is pretty straightforward. Is there any discussion questions, Senator
Bruce? Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. But it's still some other boards to try to modify workload have had the fee renewed on the date of application.
Yes,
and
or birth date.
Yes, so it's not. Okay.
No.
Okay.
Our expiration date remains October 31st of the odd numbered year.
So all renewals are November 1st.
Yes.
Okay. I guess the point was there are some boards that have gone to when you apply. It rolls, and so not everybody is renewed on the same date to kind of spread workload. And
yes.
And you do that?
We do not do
you
that.
You do not do that.
We are able to cope with the 500-plus renewals on a single date.
Okay.
It's 500.
500, a little more than 500 now.
Okay, I guess the scope is a little less than some of the other boards, so.
Yes.
Okay.
This is the state's smallest agency.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who's here to testify on the bill? Mr. Shook, do we have a fiscal on this one or not?
We do have a fiscal and a revenue.
So it's ready to go?
Yes, it is, Madam Chair.
Okay. Is there any impact from the revenue? I haven't seen it.
No, the fiscal and the impact were zero. Well, there were no fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Okay.
Okay. We do actually have those in hand.
We have them in hand, yes.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 130 and open a work session on Senate Bill 130.
And Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 130 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 130 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. Senator Cruz, do you want to carry this one?
Sure.
Okay. Senator Cruz will carry this one.
Okay.
That'll close the work session on Senate Bill 130. And I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 175. Mr. Shook, would you give us a summary of
175, Madam Chair, it revises the provisions for psychologists' licensing exemptions. It limits exemptions from psychologists' licensing requirements to 24 months for employees of state and local government agencies, community mental health programs, and drug and alcohol treatment programs. And I believe we have their executive director here today.
Okay. Who wants to go first? Deborah Orman and Susan Latham?
Yes.
Yeah. And when I was reading the statute, it's not easy language to read, so hopefully you're going to be able to explain the bill very, very simply.
Madam Chair, I'll do my best. Chairman Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Deborah Orman McHugh, and I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Psychologist Examiners. This is Susan Latham, a member representing the public voice on the board, and she's also the board chair. The board is composed of two public members and five psychologist members. The mission of this board is to protect consumers of psychological services in the state of Oregon against the unethical, unprofessional, and unlicensed practice of psychology. We are the agency that screens, tests, licenses, and disciplines psychologists. In addition, we investigate and level civil penalties against individuals who practice psychology without a license. We're here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 175 and to respond to any questions you may have about the board's intent regarding this bill. What you have before you is not a new bill, but revisions to current legislation. The main thrust of this bill is to tighten the psychologist licensing exemptions, bringing psychologists who are employed by state and local governments and community health, mental health programs, as well as drug and alcohol programs, under the authority of the board. Currently, if a PhD-trained psychologist is employed by a state, county, or local government entity, or employed by a subcontractor of a state or local governmental entity, he or she is exempt from licensure. The board believes this is a consumer protection concern. All licensed psychologists in the state of Oregon must abide by the American Psychological Association's ethical principles and code of conduct, which this board and most others across the country have adopted by rule. This ethical code of conduct is a recognized gold standard in this country as well as Canada. Unlicensed psychologists employed by state and local government agencies and/or their subcontractors may or may not abide by the standards. That is a concern for this board. The Board of Psychologist Examiners, who otherwise screens, tests, licenses, investigates complaints, and disciplines all other psychologists in the state of Oregon, is powerless to help the consumers who call the board for assistance with a complaint. The board believes that, like nurses and doctors, physical therapists, and other healthcare professionals, there should not be an automatic exemption due to the location of one's employment. From a public protection and public policy perspective, it just doesn't make sense. Finally, we have written a compromise into this bill giving psychologists currently working in these agencies 24 months to come into compliance. This is modeled after the Oregon State Hospital, which requires its new psychologists to become licensed within 2 years. That's a condition of their employment. In addition, there is some thought that perhaps the unlicensed psychologists working in these state and local and community agencies are paid less, and it makes their employment more affordable for local agencies, many of whom are nonprofits serving low-income clients. Offering a one-time, 24-month grace period would provide these agencies with a steady supply of presumably lower-cost PhD-trained psychologists who are moving toward licensure. So that's the exemption piece with state, local, community agencies. The second piece...
And do you know how many people we're talking about here?
We're talking about, I attach it to the back of my testimony, there's about 96 or 97 community mental health agencies that are subcontractors of counties.
And how many of those are not licensed with the Board of Psychologists?
They're exempt from licensure.
They're
so
exempt.
If you work in that agency, you're exempt from licensure.
So they don't?
They're not required to be licensed.
But
there
do,
are folks
but
who
do
work
they?
There who are licensed because, from what I understand, they consider part of their professional development to become licensed and such. But if they're employed there, they don't have to be licensed.
Ma'am,
yes.
Does this in any way imply that some of the people who work there are not fully qualified?
Madam Chair, Senator Morsett, I can't make that judgment.
Okay. Interesting.
Perhaps.
I can't make that judgment either. It's just not a requirement, Senator Morsett.
Pardon me?
It isn't a requirement at this time that they have. So it doesn't speak to their qualifications. It just speaks to their place of employment more.
That's interesting.
So,
Madam Chair, Senator Morsett, I can tell you anecdotally that the presumption is folks that would get a PhD in psychology, move into one of these agencies, and stay there, not getting licensed, or have not moved along in their professional development in the same way and are not interacting with their peers in the same way. That's anecdotal.
Well, Madam Chair, yeah. Without licensure, it just seems that people could have degrees, a PhD from even a university that is not fully qualified to issue that. I mean, a mail order license of...
Madam Chair, Senator Morsett, I am sure that these clinics have some standards. I don't, but
well,
you're correct. That's a possibility.
Okay, but the purpose of licensure is to have uniform standards and protect the consumer and all of those things.
Exactly.
And so I'm
right.
Surprised that we don't require a license for every practicing PhD or psychologist.
The board agrees with you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
So with this bill, the only exemption that will be left from licensure is somebody employed by a federal agency.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, no. Federal agency employees are exempt. However, the federal government requires them to be licensed somewhere. So they could be licensed in Nevada, for example, and work in Oregon, but they must be licensed somewhere. So they're all licensed. Psychologists who work for the federal government. And the other exemptions would be folks who testify in court. A psychologist could testify in court as an expert and not have to be licensed. School psychologists are licensed by the Department of Education, not by us. Other exemptions would be, I gotta look at the bill.
Research.
Working in a research institution or research project where you're not seeing clients or supervising others who see clients. Another place would be professors and folks who teach are not required to be licensed.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. The school psychologists are licensed by TSPC. How does that standard compare?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, it doesn't compare. They are allowed to use by law the title school psychologist. However, their education and experience varies.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I know. I agree.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I think at some point in time that might be worth looking into as well.
There's currently 95 school psychologists.
Would that be the difference between a master's and a PhD, perhaps?
Madam Chair, Senator Morsett, the difference in terms of a school,
what a school psychologist might have?
They have various levels of education and training and background, and they're all called school psychologists.
Okay.
They have their own schematic,
okay.
The Department of Education. The second piece of the bill is housekeeping, clarification, removing redundant language, and revising language that has unintended consequences and provides loopholes around licensure. One example, the way the law is currently written, individuals who are, quote, pursuing certification or licensure or pursuing a graduate degree in any of the certified or licensed professions, cosmetology, dentistry, and mental health, if I'm pursuing certification, I've turned in my paperwork, applied for, I'm exempt from licensure. So we can't address people who are practicing psychology as long as they're in the process of applying to something else. It is an unintended consequence of the law. This creates a gaping loophole for individuals who simply submit some licensure paperwork to any board and then sit and wait, all the while diagnosing and treating consumers, often with major mental illnesses, without oversight by any board. One pertinent example is the Board of Professional Counselors and Therapists, where an individual has up to 1 year to complete their paperwork and has up to an additional 5 years to complete their post-degree internship. It's a great system for legitimate counselors and therapists who are trying to get licensed, but a loophole for unlicensed practitioners who want to practice psychology, which is our interest. In addition, we've had two psychologists recently in the past year that this board has tried to discipline for unlicensed practice of psychology that we have found out have paperwork in process at another board, even though it's just sitting there. They've applied but not provided any backup documentation. They are in process. Never intending to pursue licensure, they're using it for that very reason, is to avoid discipline from our board. In conclusion, the board believes that an individual with a PhD in psychology who is practicing psychology needs to be licensed to do so. It makes sense from a professional development perspective, and it makes sense from a public policy and consumer safety perspective. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions members of the committee might have.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morsett.
I think that we need to do a lot of work on this bill and related issues such as psychologists prescribing psychotropic drugs under some circumstances. I mean, that's another bill that we have coming to us.
Yes.
You know, and there, it's amazing that there's not a uniform standard for people who practice psychology in the state of Oregon. And the fact that you can be in the process of getting your paperwork and ever intend on doing it is simply just postponing that. And yet these are people who are diagnosing and working with the public and consumers and so on. So I think we need to do... I'd like to have the Department of Education come and talk about what their standards are, for one. That would be one.
It opens up a whole...
Well, it does. Area. But I think now that it's here, we should... I certainly wouldn't want to carry this bill on the floor if we didn't have... If we didn't examine some of the loopholes and unintended consequences and so on.
Madam Chair, Senator Morsett, I'm not aware of any controversy with the Department of Ed wanting to hang on to those folks.
That's
or
fine.
Anything like that.
No, I think that we're charged with oversight.
Yes.
And consumer protection, and I think we just have to look at some of these things that come up that we don't have an answer to or that raise other questions.
So we have DHS and the schools and the clinics.
Madam Chair, the fiscal statement indicated the Oregon Board of Psychological Examiners, the government unit affected, Department of Human Services, Department of Corrections, Oregon Youth Authority, and the Public Defense Services Commission are the four or five that the fiscal department have indicated as having some effect. Did not mention the public schools.
Okay.
Well, Madam Chair, yes. School psychologists, I think, are probably a different category. My only reason for bringing that up was it'd be nice to maybe hear from Vicki Chamberlain as to what the standards are, simply. They aren't necessarily dealing with severe mental problems. They can, but their scope is just advising kids that are dealing with kid issues, so which are severe for the kids but may not necessarily rise to the critical level at all times. So I don't necessarily want, I mean, if the core principle we're trying to get at here is if you have a PhD in psychology, you should be licensed, I'd agree with that. So, you know, if that's the core issue we're trying to deal with, let's make sure that is exactly what we're doing. So,
okay. Further discussion? All right. Thank you very much. And Dr. Brian Hartman?
I'd also point out, Madam Chair, that when they go to testify before the House Committee, assuming the House is on the same track we are, they may need to change their testimony because the makeup of the board may have changed by then. So.
All right.
Madam Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Dr. Brian Hartman. I'm a licensed psychologist, and I'm representing the Oregon Psychological Association this morning. I'm assisted by one of my regular interpreters, Crystal Withers, who has been provided by the Oregon Psychological Association. The Oregon Psychological Association is standing in favor of SB 175, which revises positions for psychologist licensing exemptions and limits exemption from psychologist licensing requirements to 24 months for employees of state and local government agencies, community mental health programs, and drug and alcohol treatment programs. We believe that requiring psychologists who work in exempt settings to become licensed provides necessary protection to the public. Obtaining licensure within 2 years or ending practice as a licensed psychologist in an exempt setting requires meeting the standards of training that best serve and protect the public. For example, national written exam, supervised residency, and state written jurisprudence examination. Supervised residency, in particular, provides the training and experience which best serves the public by teaching and practicing the standards of ethical care for Oregonians. This bill would have no effect at Oregon State Hospital, where I practice, as this requirement for licensure is currently in place at Oregon State Hospital. While this requirement is currently in place in many exempt settings, there are numerous settings where psychologists are currently working without licensure. OPA is concerned that some of these unlicensed practitioners are working in public settings with some of the state's most vulnerable citizens. These settings can and do become safe havens for practitioners who have lost their licenses or who are unable to become licensed for a variety of reasons. We're concerned that there are currently no board that provides oversight of the practice of these unlicensed psychologists, which means that there is no disciplinary process in place if these individuals engage in unethical practice. In summary, the Oregon Psychological Association supports SB 175 as it provides greater protection of the public and promotes the safe and ethical practice of psychology in the state of Oregon.
Question? Yes, Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there some background with respect to 24 months versus 12 months or some other time frame?
I can only speak from my own experience in terms of this. I would have had significant difficulty within the state system being licensed had there been a 12-month window, because you need a certain number of hours, which are difficult to get in under a year. You also have to take a written examination. 2 years was pretty tight. When I initially was a resident at the state hospital, it took about 6 months for me to get my contract approved through the board. By the time I got set up with my supervisor, completed all the paperwork, got it submitted to the board, and got approval back from the Board of Psychologist Examiners, almost 6 months was up. Had it been a year, I would not have been able to complete my time. I was under supervision the entire time of a licensed psychologist. Subsequently, I think that it has improved because people have, because now we do have a more streamlined approach to being able to accomplish our paperwork and be able to begin accruing our hours more readily. But I think that 24 months is a reasonable amount of time should you need to retake the national exam, which is a very difficult. I've kind of started to suppress it at this point, but several hundred questions, like if I remember right, 225 questions, multiple choice of everything and anything within psychology. There were things I did not learn in grad school on that test. Many people have to retake that test. And there are statutory times laid out to how much time has to lapse before you can take it again. And then you have to take the jurisprudence, which is only offered twice a year. So, for example, and you have to have 60 days between the time you complete the national written exam and the time that you take the jurisprudence test. So to put it within a year is a very, very, very tight time frame and is likely unaccomplishable and does not leave any room for flexibility or life, or, you know, you have a car accident and you're out of work for a month. There is no flexibility within a year. 2 years does give you that flexibility.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other discussion? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's no one else signed up to testify in this bill, and I truly feel that Department of Human Services, Corrections, OIA, needs to give us some information regarding the psychologists that they have, how this would impact them. So we will, this is still under advice, I mean, this we will still be considering this bill, but until we get people who can speak from DHS, I think we'll just close the public hearing on Senate Bill 175 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 272.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 272 eliminates the requirement for consent to take blood samples of pregnant women for testing for infectious conditions as required by the Department of Human Services.
Okay. Senator Prozanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it all right? I'd like to have Doug Barber.
Doug Barber.
Come join me. Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, Floyd Prozanski, State Senator, District 4.
The reason Senate Bill 272 is before you is a constituent of mine who is a physician who practices in the Eugene-Springfield area by the name of Robert Pels and his partner, Robert Barnes, brought this to my attention as to a concern that there are, from their perspective, from their reading and the attorneys that they work with, their interpretation, is that there's a requirement that prior to taking a blood draw for testing for HIV of a pregnant woman, that you have to have their consent to do so. And if they choose not to, then it is prohibited. Their concern is to try to combat an issue that they have been faced with, I would say most recently, March of 2006, where a woman who refused to give the consent was in fact unknown to herself HIV positive, and then the baby girl who was delivered from that patient turned out to be infected HIV through what is known as vertical transmission from her mother from the pregnancy. What Dr. Peltz had shared with me, and he wants to apologize that he couldn't be here today himself because of his schedule, but that he wanted to make certain that there would be a way that you could actually determine whether or not there was HIV issues, and that based on their information, that if you know this going through the pregnancy, there's medication that can be used to decrease the risk of vertical HIV transmission, and that it can reduce it from roughly 25% down to less than 2%. So it's a significant means of keeping babies from coming into the with a vertical transmission of HIV. The other information that they've provided me is that they had some questions as to why there would be a need for HIV testing to be informed as compared to other sexual transmittable diseases that are currently can be tested without consent. So this is what the information and the perspective of why we have Senate Bill 272 before this committee, but I want to share with you additional information I've learned today. And speaking with DHS, it is their interpretation currently that the permission is for the blood draw, and exclusively the blood draw, that the test itself for HIV can in fact be ran without the individual being fully apprised and consenting to it. Clearly, in speaking with them, as well as what I believe Dr. Pels would want, is to make certain that there's consent knowledge of what's going on, not in the sense of doing something without the patient's information. But I guess the long and short of this is possibly the bill may not need to move forward, and we're going to ask that the committee at the conclusion of this public hearing to hold the bill to see whether or not we can address these issues administratively. It could be that if the interpretation of DHS is correct as to what is now required versus what isn't required, because previously informed consent was the measure, and informed consent is much greater and broader than just actual consent, and I'll leave that for DHS to explain in greater detail as to what's required between the two. But right now, it could be just a simple misunderstanding and interpretation of what is currently on the books, and if so, then DHS said that they would like to clarify that through administrative rule, exactly what is allowed and permissible, and still what is required through consent and the sense of knowledge. I believe that covers what I was going to put on the record for this morning, and Mr. Barber is here as a lobbyist for Peace Health, who my constituent works for, and it's based on the definitions, or I should say the interpretation of the attorneys who represent Peace Health is why this bill came forward. Also in the room is, as I mentioned previously, representatives from DHS, and they could also give you greater insight as to their interpretation and the steps they would like to see taken after the conclusion or at the conclusion of this hearing.
Thank you. Was it in Senator Morissette's committee that we were dealing with HIV consent? I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was. There's still a stigma in this state. It's considered a gay disease, and there's just which it is not, and which it is sexually transmitted. So we get into civil rights issues, and we get lots of opposition on this topic. Is there any questions for the senator? Yeah, Senator Cruz.
Getting back to the bill we heard, I mean, it's not just Oregon, it's a CDC thing as well. So, I mean, for some reason, globally, HIV is still considered a separate critter from everything else, and so you got to do special things to do that in normal course of business, and that's what you're trying to address here?
I guess the clarity, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, the clarity that Dr. Pels and his associate, Dr. Barnes, were looking for is a means to be able to determine whether or not during the pregnancy of a woman, whether or not the child is potentially affected with HIV, and to be able to take steps during the pregnancy to reduce that risk, so upon birth the child would not be, vertically transmitted, through vertical transmission, receive and be positive HIV. So the part about the consent is the concern that they had was that the doctors for Peace Health, the attorneys for the Peace Health have informed at least this group of doctors that they still need to follow the old rule of informed consent. And informed consent is much broader and actually written consent, and actually have someone sign on the dotted line that they are giving this with their full knowledge of what the potential risks are, etc., and also that the test was going to be for HIV.
All right, Madam Chair, which is the distinction at this point, because they're already doing a blood draw and doing this rather massive screen anyway, but then we've got to go through separate things just to test, because the informed consent deals only with the HIV test, I'm assuming, not the screen that normally happens. And that's the break in the system.
It's my understanding, though, that CDC now has considered HIV a routine test, and it is the state of Oregon that still is digging our heels in.
Well, we're just behind the curve.
Yeah, we're behind the curve.
And Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, it's my understanding from speaking with DHS, at this point, the consent that's required under Oregon law is for the draw of the blood.
Just for the draw of the blood.
But apparently, maybe through misinterpretations, miscommunications, or just plain, risk prone, the attorneys for these two doctors have been informing them that they needed to go through a greater step. And if that's the case, from what DHS has told me, they feel that this may be able to be addressed through administrative rule, making that clear. But they also want to make certain their current interpretation is correct, because if we have one set of attorneys saying one thing, they wanted to make certain that their representative of the Department of Justice would agree with the agency's perspective, because if he or she does not, then I believe they may want to use this bill to make the clarifications that might be necessary.
Madam Chair, this is kind of crazy. Dr. Bates, when I go to my doctor and I have tests, he sends me down to have my blood drawn. Now, at some point, I would have had to consent to have my blood drawn in a doctor's office, in a hospital.
Usually when you enter a doctor, and this is always done, so I'm on thin ice here, okay? There are things you sign a consent form for when you enter an office. As an example, in Medicare, if you're a Medicare patient, you sign a very convoluted consent form that says if Medicare doesn't pay for the test, you're going to be responsible for the test. And it's almost impossible language to even understand what that says, as an example. You also, when you sign up with a physician, generally speaking, you have a consent form that he or she will do those things that are appropriate in that office that you'd normally expect to do. And so there's a consent given to draw blood, to do examinations. We don't write every individual thing down. As I read the statute that is presently in place, it is pretty strange. And I'm going to thank the senator for bringing this forward. What it says is, in all cases that are relating to blood being drawn from a pregnant woman. Now, the physician shall request consent of the patient to take a blood sample. The preceding paragraph says you can run the HIV test, but you have to get permission to draw the blood sample. I'm not sure that many physicians are aware of that. I did OB for 25 years, and we may have had something in there for that, but I'm not sure that we did. It was just sort of assumed you drew blood. The question always behind that was, what tests are you going to run off that blood? Mm-hmm. But the statute, the way it reads now, say you can run those tests. You're not restricted from doing that. But you got to have consent to draw the blood. Right. And if the patient knows why you're drawing the blood, they may not give that consent to draw the blood. So I think what you want to do with the statute is get rid of the consent to draw the blood is a probable situation, or have some form the patient signs that says, we're going to do the usual customary things in for your pregnancy. So I think that's what you're looking at right now as far as this is concerned.
And Madam Chair and Senator Bates, that's correct from the perspective of my constituent is how I would interpret it. Mm-hmm. But I also want to make certain that, you know, DHS has an opportunity to put on the record, because I think in this day and time, we want to make certain that in that doctor-patient relationship that there is that communication as to what's going on. And I believe in just outright taking out or adding in that phrase that would modify this bill to my constituents' request may be overbroad from what it would be good doctor-patient relationships and communication. So I understand there's a couple other groups that are here that, from my understanding in the hallway, that they're wanting to stay neutral and they work with the group. Of course, we will be very open to anyone that wants to be part of it to determine what, if anything, needs to happen with the bill after today.
Okay.
Great stuff.
Yes, thank you. Do you need to say anything, Mr. Barber?
Chairman Sanderson, I'm Doug Barber here on behalf of Peace Health. We just found out that this was a Peace Health physician who had brought this bill late yesterday afternoon. Committee Administrator Mr. Shook contacted us about it. So we have people reviewing it now. We're trying to sort out what our attorneys have said or what they believe. We're happy to work with Senator Brzezinski and the others on this and with DHS to try to make sure that we're all on the same page in terms of what kind of consent or informed consent is required. So at that point, that's about all I know on it.
Okay.
Well, Madam Chair, as you may be aware, there's some really difficult issues here. Public safety, public health, the rights of the individual patient, what physicians want to do or not do. Really tough one about, does the fetus have rights and what does that mean?
Right.
There's a whole bunch of stuff here that are going to be very difficult. So have a good time.
That's tough.
Okay.
It's not as simple as it looks.
We have, is it Gene? I can't read.
Sean.
Oh, Sean. Yes, Sean Schaefer, Public Health. Public Health. And Patty O'Sullivan. How could I forget?
Good morning. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Department of Human Services. And with me is Dr. Sean Schaefer, who will give most of the testimony. But just we just all did a quick round circle out there in the hall. And Senator Brzezinski is right. We interpret these statutes one way in combination with another statute. And Peace Health's lawyers, maybe being risk-averse, have interpreted it a different way, and what we would like to do is go ahead and talk to our attorneys and make sure that it is indeed our interpretation. It's what we've always believed, and we've gone along believing that and have administrative rules to back that up. But we want to double check so that we're not giving some bad advice. And if, in fact, our interpretation is correct, we would want to make sure that we get something out to all the physicians and hospitals explaining the interpretation of these combinations of statutes so that they know what they are allowed and not allowed to do. And with that, I'll just turn it over to Dr. Schaefer.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, I'm Sean Schaefer. I'm a medical epidemiologist and public health physician with the HIV program in the Oregon Public Health Division. And as you've heard, Senate Bill 272 eliminates the requirement that a physician obtain consent to collect a blood sample for infectious diseases, including HIV, during pregnancy. The proposed revision would substitute this requirement with an explicit statement that consent is not required to collect the sample. So the Oregon Public Health Division doesn't believe that specific informed consent should be required for HIV testing during pregnancy, precisely for the reason that we want to see testing maximized during pregnancy and reduce the rate of vertical transmission from mothers to their infants. In Oregon, we haven't seen a reported case of an infected newborn since 2006. Already, we revised our statute, the one in question today, in 2005 to, at the time we understood, to remove the requirement that specific informed consent be required for testing during pregnancy. So that's 433.045. It actually provides an exception to informed consent for HIV testing in pregnant women. So while not strictly necessary, Senate Bill 272 would eliminate ambiguous language about consent to collect a specimen for HIV testing during pregnancy. Nonetheless, we would encourage physicians to advise their patients when HIV testing is done. Therefore, we'd like to work with the bill sponsors on this particular language that indicates that while informed consent is not explicitly required, the patient should be informed that testing will be conducted unless she declines. This is consistent with what's known as the opt-out approach to HIV testing, which is espoused by the Centers for Disease Control and by our own public health division. Thanks very much, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
That's great. I knew that there was something, and it's the opt-out rather than the opt-in. Yeah. Okay.
Madam Chair, you may have clarified in rule, but in the ORS, it is contradictory. So, I mean, Section 1, the first two subsections require a physician to do something, and then, oh, by the way, no, is basically what it says. So, and personally, I would, I'm not sure that at this point in time, I would like to get away in statute from us making specific reference to HIV when it should be part of a broader screen.
That's right.
So, you know, I mean, if we're trying to change the culture, that's one way to change the culture, is not drawing attention to something, because we're talking about, condition that may impact the pregnant woman or fetus, and we're talking about potentially communicable diseases or other things, and clearly that HIV should be part of that screen, and I would like to see us get away from making specific reference, so if that's possible.
All right. Thank you. And I think, Andy, do you want to come up or not? We're not going to work the bill, so, okay. All right, any other further discussion on Senate Bill 272? We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 272. And, colleagues, we're going to reopen a work session on Senate Bill 25. And, Sasha, do you want to come forward? She found out some information from us, from, the, I assume, the president of the Senate office.
Yes, Senator Monica Anderson, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Sasha Pollack. I work for Senator Courtney's office. And I have actually two pieces of new information, one related to the fiscal recommendation. I have heard that it is requested that the committee make a recommendation on whether or not it go to Ways and Means or not, because the fiscal is so small. That is what the president's office would suggest.
Okay.
And
the other piece?
I appreciated Senator Bates' kind words, but I wanted to make some clarifications for the record. Because the amendments were not available to the advocacy folks until a very late date, and I apologize for that, there are some concerns and there are some clarifications that need to be made just on the record. It is my interpretation from what I've talked to both Laura Smith and Bob Jundeff about this. The advocacy folks interpreted this board to be a board solely made up of outside perspective looking in at the public hearings. I think that it was the impression of the committee, and you can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, that there was an interest of some representation from the staff of the hospital who have day-to-day dealings with the consumers. And so that was the intent in drafting the dash four. I also, I have heard that there's some misinterpretation on what's actually in the dash four, so I wanted to state for the record what's actually in the bill as amended in the dash four in terms of the makeup of the board very quickly, if that's all right. Instead of three advocates, we will go to two advocates. Instead of three exterior healthcare professionals, that will go to two. There will still be two consumers on the board and one family member. There was a misunderstanding that the family member had been eliminated. That is not the case. And then one member of the general public who lives in the vicinity as opposed to two. And then the three additional members of the represented staff will be added to that, in addition, obviously, to two legislative members. I just wanted to also clarify, it's the understanding, I believe, of folks that this is not a collective bargaining union board. This is a board dealing with patient care, concerned about patient care, and is specifically inside the Oregon State Hospital. And that was why the perspective of both those exterior professionals and the interior staff, as well as the advocates and consumers, was all was important to the committee members.
So, when if there's some problem, would you recommend us waiting a day to pass it out to get some input from the people who had been very involved in designing the advisory committee as it was intended originally?
Madam Chair, I certainly leave that up to the committee. I think that there was a fundamental kind of discrepancy between the interpretation of what the advocacy folks thought this board was for and what I think that the committee and the committee that introduced the bill thought this bill, that this board was for. I think there will still continue to be some concerns, but I think some of that is alleviated with the understanding that this is still continuing to be a board for patient care and the health of the consumers and the clients at the state hospital.
Mm-hmm. I think, having been a nurse, sometimes the insight from the staff, and especially since you have a consumer too, it's well-rounded. But what's the
feeling of the committee?
Okay. Good bill.
My sense is a much better bill. I can understand, with the history of the state hospital, the difficulty that the advocates have. They just don't want this going back to where it was before. But I think the staff has really valuable input to offer. I think the staff at the hospital was as upset as the advocates were about how this had deteriorated. So having both of them have an opportunity to sit on a board and discuss issues with themselves really should be helpful. And from what I see here as sort of the makeup of the board, the majority of the board is still in the advocacy side. It just allows some input from inside. And the inside advocacy before was just the director. This opens it up to a nurse, a physician, and a line member. So I think this is probably a chance to make it a better bill and a better board.
I would agree, and let's keep in mind that at this point in time, it's an advisory board. If if we're going at some point to a governing board, we may want to relook at the makeup at
Absolutely.
That point.
Absolutely.
And my other question is, Senator Bates, do you want this or not?
I want it.
No. What? Do you want this or not? Floor or you?
Oh, for me?
Do you want it in your sub, or do you want to send it to the floor?
I would if the physical's small, I'd rather send it to the floor. I mean, the process to go through Ways and Means and have to go through the discussion two more times.
It's going to go anyway, so let's do it.
Yeah.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 25 to the floor with the pass.
Amended.
Are we in a work session?
We are in work session. I move Senate Bill 25 as amended by the dash 1 and dash 4 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
With a request. to rescind.
It doesn't have a referral.
That's true.
It doesn't have a referral, so that's it.
All right. Senator Cruz has moved Senate Bill 25 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes. I'd like to say that's a good precedent to set.
We will use this in future
bills. Thank you very much.
We'll call Sasha down. Is there any opposition? So ordered. And would Senator Courtney want to carry this bill? Probably. Let's have Senator Courtney carry the bill.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Before we adjourn.
Okay. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 25.
I just have a question, and this is a for the record question. A woman cannot opt out, I hope, of a HIV test before she do. If a pregnant woman. Is that what you're saying? That there is an opt-out clause for people with HIV to... That's unthinkable.
This way they
No, we have to fix that. I mean, because that's not a right. You have the right of the baby to live without it, you know, free of a disease. So there cannot be an opt-out clause for an HIV.
Can the state force you to give blood is another issue.
Well, okay, that's the issue. But when that came up at the very end, you said, oh, an opt-out. Well, that, you know, there's a life of a baby that is involved here. Well, it can't be.
We require blood tests for marriage.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
This is the law is ambiguous.
Well, I think
hepatitis B, syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia,
all of that's
HIV.
Covered.
All, we have to include that. That's
right.
Yeah.
Can we write language?
But they can opt out of taking that.
No, they can't opt out.
Defined by
it's
all right. We are adjourned.
Thank you.